Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. It seems clear that since the shock of September 11, we've been through several stages in our thinking about Islamic terrorism, and that each major terrorist event seems to permanently change the way the public thinks about the situation overall. Bali made Australians see that the terrorists hate us because we drink beer and go to the beach. The murder of Theo van Gogh in Holland made Europeans realise their liberal political institutions were under attack. The bombing on the London Underground focused public attention on the idea of the homegrown terrorist. And after the foiled plot in Glasgow, the public is still absorbing the implications of a group of doctors being allegedly involved. The response in the op-ed pages of the newspapers has been very interesting. Within a few days, a series of weighty pieces all saying the same thing. Tanvir Ahmed, writing in The Australian, said the latest attack in Britain shows how the Islamist threat is being driven by something much grander than mere foreign policy or feelings of grievance. I believe that theology is central and not peripheral to the problem. A few days later, Canada's Irshad Manji said, no, religion was the root cause of the Islamist threat. Meanwhile, in the London Observer, a former jihadi, Hassan Butt, wrote that the real engine of our violence is Islamic theology, not British or American foreign policy. Well, Andrew Bostom is a doctor himself. In fact, he's Associate Professor of Medicine at Brown University Medical School. He's the author of The Legacy of Jihad and a forthcoming book, The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism. And he joins us on the phone from his home in Rhode Island. Andrew, hello. Do you see any link between these responses and the involvement of doctors in the Glasgow plot?
Yes, Stephen. I think as a practicing physician myself who still sees patients, it was an appalling violation of the basic medical ethos. But my reaction was twofold. First of all, to sit back rationally and realize that, you know, unfortunately, physicians have played prominent roles in some of the most high-profile jihad terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda itself. As everyone knows, Ayman al-Zawahiri, his father was an instructor at a major medical school in Egypt, came out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Zawahiri himself is supposed to be a gifted surgeon. There are other high-profile leaders of Palestinian terrorist organizations.
Hamas, I think.
Hamas, yes. The late pediatrician al-Rantisi was a Hamas leader. Mahmoud al-Zahar is a surgeon and lecturer at the Islamic University in Gaza, and he's a hardliner's hardliner. The late Fatih Shikaki founded Islamic Jihad, and he was also a physician. So this is not...
It's not just engineers.
No, it's not just engineers, but I think the public reaction to having this litany recounted and then seeing the more garden variety and, frankly, thank goodness, rather inept plotters in Glasgow and London begins to also question the notion that poverty is a major driver of this kind of behavior. It's difficult to see well-established physicians who are lucratively rewarded for their work in both Islamic and non-Islamic countries having poverty as a primary motivation. So they begin to drift towards ideological motivations in combination with the fact that you're getting progressive Muslims, including in Australia, a remarkable physician, psychiatrist, Dr. Ahmed.
This is Tanvir Ahmed.
Yes, talking about how we must come to terms with the relationship between these behaviors and core teachings of Islam. And so I think the public, which has been, I think, directed away from that line of thinking for both positive and negative reasons. I mean, I was one of those people who was concerned when Bush was using the religion of peace moniker right after 9/11. On the other hand, he was, I think, genuinely concerned about a xenophobic overreaction which thank goodness didn't occur in the United States, but there was the potential for that kind of reaction.
In the days after Glasgow, I've certainly observed here in our major Australian newspapers several articles, one by Tanveer Ahmed, one by Irshad Manji from Canada, a very important article by a former jihadi named Hassan Butt in the London Observer in the UK, all basically saying the same thing, that religion, theology, not foreign policy, not Palestine, not Iraq, religion and theology are the key factors driving this terrorism. And I wonder whether you can see any link between Glasgow and that line all of a sudden.
I think the fact that you're getting progressive Muslims, whether they're still believing Muslims or secularists that come out of an Islamic culture, being willing to have the courage, like the people you mentioned possess, to make that connection and, in effect, to chastise not at least equally, not just their own communities, but the Western host societies in both Australia and Britain for also not being willing to engage in this kind of discussion. To me, that's at least as striking as their observation and their cajoling of their Muslim co-religionists. This has also come up in some of these discussions that it's not just the Muslims who have to engage in this discussion. It's the non-Muslim host societies that can't shy away from these issues. And that to me is almost more remarkable.
Your books, your previous book on the history of jihad, your forthcoming book on the deep history of anti-Semitism in Islam, seem to be aimed, in fact, at demonstrating many of the most basic views taught about Islam in our universities, for example, are simply wrong.
That's got to be part of the discussion. Non-Muslims have to be educated in these doctrines, as dry and forbidding and in some cases disturbing as they are. They also have to be educated in terms of how these doctrines have played out historically with facts on the ground history. And this has to be done in a non-Bowdlerized kind of way that, frankly, doesn't place first and foremost the sensibility of pious Muslim believers that wants to get at disturbing but objectively verifiable truths as close as possible. And so I think that, in effect, courageous Muslims like Dr. Ahmed are providing the space to do that. And this is very important.
You're writing a lot about the caliphate at the moment and also a lot about the Islamization of Europe. You know, we were just talking about stages in the public's appreciation of the issues around Islamic terrorism. I wonder whether there are, in fact, stages in the way that the Muslim community living in the West is responding and whether, in fact, there may well be cause for optimism in some ways.
I think there's cause for some optimism, but I think it's a very guarded optimism. I mean, for example, as I was trying to come up to speed for an Australian show, you know, I was just coming across something about, you know, Muslim cabbies recruiting for jihad in Melbourne, and then the fact that, you know, you've had two high-profile leaders of both the Shiite and the Sunni community, the infamous Taj al-Din Hilali, Kamal Musumani, the head of the Islamic Shia Council of Australia. We're still seeing that there's significant radicalism at the highest levels. On the other hand, the fact that persons like Dr. Ahmed are stepping forward to make these very, very strong pronouncements and feel comfortable enough to do that, I take as a good sign. The background for me, though, as someone who's trained in epidemiology and is used to looking at survey data, again, I must confess, I remain very concerned because the best survey data that I've ever seen on the fundamental questions of the desire for a caliphate, the desire to impose, and the survey asked specifically, strict Islamic law, I was floored by how wide these sentiments are, how deep they are in the greater Muslim world. The data that I'm referring to were published in April, and they comprised...
This survey by the University of Maryland.
Yes, the University of Maryland and World Opinion Dynamics, it's a survey of roughly 4,400 Muslims from major important countries, two major Arab countries, Morocco and Egypt, which is the most populous Arab Muslim country, and then the two most populous Muslim countries overall in the world, Pakistan, the second most populous country, and Indonesia, the largest Muslim population in the world, when very straightforward questions were posed to this sample of 4,400 Muslims, roughly broken down between 10 to 1,100 per country, the findings that were striking to me was a simple question asked in a local dialect in a face-to-face interview about the desire for the caliphate. 65% of this sample was in favor of a supranational, traditional Muslim caliphate. And 65%, we don't know if there's exact concordance between these two questions, but 65%, attesting to some extent to the internal validity of the prior question, 65% of this same sample said that they wanted the application of, quote, strict Sharia law in all the Islamic countries. So there's a vast reservoir of sentiments that are anathema to what liberal Western societies uphold. And this, in essence, has to be the ultimate pool from which the more violent jihadists are recruiting.
Yes, on the other hand, though, when you bury down into some of the other questions in that survey, it's interesting that there are very high figures opposing attacks on civilian populations, 84% of Indonesians, 81% of Pakistanis, 77% of Egyptians opposed to attacks on civilians.
Absolutely, and these are reassuring trends so that we don't have to think in terms of, you know, 800 million people, you know, ready to wage violent jihad campaigns. On the other hand, you're now seeing Sharia states essentially in accord with the early 1990s model in Algeria, which after all started out nonviolently, which is Islamic State by the will of the people. And when you transpose, even at a much lower percentage, for example, survey data from Great Britain suggested that 35 to 40% of the Muslims in Great Britain wished ultimately to replace the British constitutional system with Sharia law. And again, we're not talking about violent overthrow here, but the fact that it's nonviolent and that the goal is a Sharia state poses a dilemma, and I would argue that it's ominous.
Here in Australia, we're having a debate at the moment about a particular group that supports the caliphate named Hizbut Tahrir. A group that's banned in the UK but not here at present, in favour of the restoration of the caliphate, but says that it's opposed to terrorist violence. Now, I recall that back at the height of the Cold War, Australians voted in a very famous referendum against banning the Communist Party. And I wonder whether we should think about groups like Hizbut Tahrir almost as if they were the new Trotskyites, romantic, deluded internationalists that you need to keep an eye on, but certainly within the limits of toleration in a liberal democratic society.
Well, I think that's very dangerous because, first of all, there's the whole phenomenon of what happens when their goals are thwarted. The reactions often turn violent. This is precisely what happened in Algeria. And then Hizbut Tahrir, in particular, has also had concrete ties to terrorism, despite its renunciations. It's also interesting, the Muslim Brotherhood is a hotly debated issue. But a liberal investigative journalist from Switzerland came upon a cache of documents, Sylvain Besson, where the Muslim Brotherhood in Europe outlined its sort of phased approach to implementing the Sharia. So I could be wrong, but my take on these organizations is that the peaceful phase is a facade.
Great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Andrew Bostom speaking to us from Rhode Island, and his book, forthcoming, is The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism, on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod. This is the Religion Report. Well, the latest terror plot in the UK has coincided with the launch of a new British Council of Ex-Muslims, part of a Europe-wide phenomenon of Muslims in the West who are publicly renouncing their religion. There are now public associations of Muslim apostates in Germany, Finland, Denmark, Norway and Sweden, and Australia could be next. Mariam Namazi is the spokesperson for the organisation. She's an ex-Muslim who came to Britain from Iran as a refugee, and she joins us from London. Mariam, what was behind this idea?
Well, I mean, it's an organization that we've established for several reasons. I guess the main one is really the fact that the political Islamic movement is wreaking havoc across the world, and we wanted to create an organization that would bring attention to that fact, but also challenge it from a unique position, really, a position of people who've left Islam and who have first-hand experience of the political Islamic movement and the violations that it's committing, not only in the Middle East and North Africa, where it's been able to reign freely for several decades, but more recently in the Western Europe. And one of the things that we've done that's quite interesting, I think, that's caught a lot of attention, is the fact that today, for people who want to leave Islam, they're still deemed apostates. It's punishable by death in many countries. And even in countries that aren't under Islamic rule, you find people facing intimidation and threats for doing so. And so we thought we would do something publicly where people who've left Islam would show their faces, their names, and do it as a public challenge, really. And even though we all believe that leaving religion is a private affair, and one of the things we're fighting for is secularism and the separation of religion from the state, because religion is now so much part of the public sphere, and particularly Islam, we felt that we had to do this renunciation publicly as well.
What has the response been to the launch in Britain?
I'm actually quite surprised at the response. It's been overwhelmingly positive, and there's been so many people who've basically contacted us saying we're closet ex-Muslims, we're closet atheists. You know, we felt we had no voice, and finally now here's an organization that represents so many of us that haven't been comfortable to come out and say that we don't believe in Islam, we renounce it, and we don't want religion to be part of politics and the political sphere and the public sphere.
Sounds like your organization hopes to be psychologically important, a support to people coming out, almost like some of the gay pride movements were in the early 70s, for example.
Yes, I mean, definitely. That's one example that we've often given, is that it is a way of helping people to be able to come out and really breaking the taboo and making it easier for people to do that. But again, that becoming easier is part of an overall challenge to a movement that doesn't allow people to leave easily.
There's very little information on the number of people leaving Islam when they come to live in the West, for obvious reasons. What information do you have in Britain?
I mean, again, I think there was an article in the Times which extrapolated the number to be about 200,000 people who've left Islam. Again, they had also mentioned the fact that there are underground networks like railroads that, you know, how slaves were freed, for example. There were underground networks that helped them escape, that those exist, including in Britain, to help people escape situations where they're under threat. I think the numbers are actually very, very great.
What's your own membership at this stage?
Well, we started with 25 people because we followed the German example. Maybe our membership has tripled already, to the extent that we're getting, you know, requests for membership every day, and we're actually struggling to deal with all the requests for membership and for support and forums and so on and so forth.
Mm. I should mention too that the movement started in Germany, in fact, and that there are in fact numerous branches throughout, well, Scandinavia.
Exactly. I mean, actually, Mina Ahadi, she started it in Germany, and it started in several countries in Scandinavia as well. We've actually already had requests from Belgium, Australia, from the United States,
from Australia,
and Canada as well, yes, to start it. And we are working with people to see what their networks are. We are encouraging people to work with humanists and secularists in those countries, and they've been very crucial in our launching our organizations in other countries that we have been able to launch them. So we are working with actually people in Australia as well to set up something like that.
Mariam, tell me about your own experience leaving Islam, because I think you've had, well, numerous death threats.
Well, I mean, again, the leaving of Islam, I mean, I think people have asked me that before. It hasn't been something where I thought, oh my goodness, it happened on this date at this exact moment. And I think it was a process, really. It was something that, I guess, came as a result of leaving Iran, the whole refugee experience, really. I think during that course of events, you start to question more why people have to be treated this way, that experience of having to leave. And then when you do challenge it, when you're active against it, and not necessarily to begin with politically, but in defending women's rights, for example, in defending refugee rights, which is the avenue I took and the work that I did, you end up actually having to question the reason why people flee, and it comes to religion and power, really.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Mariam Nemazi, who's the spokesperson for the new British Council of Ex-Muslims. Well, the Bishop of Rome has done it again. He's just upset about nearly everyone by reasserting the absolutist claims of the Catholic Church. Catholics are still the best. Guy Sebastian should hang up his hat. That could be the real anthem for World Youth Day next year. Well, the majority of Catholics I know are cringing with embarrassment at the Vatican's latest affirmation that the Catholic Church is the one true church and all the other churches are defective. Pope Benedict calls them ecclesial bodies. They're not rightfully churches at all. The reaction from some of these defective churches has been surprisingly light-hearted, however. The Sydney Anglicans and the Catholics used to be old foes, but the Anglican Bishop of South Sydney, Robert Forsyth, says, don't worry, the Pope is just being the Pope. Bishop Forsyth joins us now in our Sydney studios, together with ABC producer Peter Kirkwood from Compass on ABC TV. He's the author of The Quiet Revolution, his just-released book on new trends in interfaith dialogue. Bishop Forsyth, you say that at least these days you lot don't refer to the Pope as the Antichrist. You're not upset.
Well, my response was that the Pope is a Catholic. He was merely reaffirming Catholic doctrine. This has been said for 400 years. I don't believe what he said is true. I'm grieved to hear it at one level. But another, why should I be surprised to hear the Pope declaring Roman Catholic doctrine?
So in other words, this is just the Pope saying he's a Catholic.
Well, I'm not sure what... I think it's not my business to describe what the Pope's doing. I suspect Pope Benedict is seeking to reaffirm Catholic identity. We're seeing that in a number of aspects, the Latin Mass, the emphasis on liturgy. But from the point of view of a Protestant or an Anglican, to be told that this is the Church's teaching is no news to us. It's always been the Church's teaching, and we've had to learn to live with and love Roman Catholics and get on with each other. In a sense, despite of that, we know that there are irreconcilable differences between Roman Catholics and non-Roman Catholics, and there's no point wishing them away. You've got to love your brothers and sisters and work with them, as I think we do.
You say we've come a long way from the days when you lot used to say that the Pope was the Antichrist.
Well, there was a time, as you well know.
When precisely was that dropped?
Well, I'm trying to work that out.
I was wondering whether a decision had been made at some standing committee meeting that the ABC Religion Department hadn't been told about.
No, the ABC Religion Department may qualify for that claim sometimes, I'm afraid. If you look back in, I was looking back in our litany, set prayers, and it's interesting, from 1549, that is when the first English prayer book came in the split when the English church split from Rome, there is this prayer, and I'll just pray it for you. From all sedition and privy conspiracy, from the tyranny of the Bishop of Rome and all his detestable enormities, from all false doctrine and heresy, from hardness of heart and contempt of thy word and commandments, good Lord, deliver us. That was dropped in 1559 when Queen Elizabeth returned the Anglican church to its freedom from the Bishop of Rome. And I don't think Anglicans have officially called the Pope the Antichrist. It is, however, in the Westminster Confession, the Presbyterians, and that's still in some places maybe technically current today. Go back to that time when there's a massive fight going on. Here is a man that seems, from some Protestant point of view, a man who claims to be Christian but seems in so many ways to be undoing the Christian faith. It's so easy to draw the link. That sounds like an antichrist. But I wouldn't for a moment want to use that language. The Pope is a Catholic, not the antichrist.
And what about your dean, Philip Jensen?
I don't think he's the antichrist either. He's a very
Let's come back to your serious point, because okay. It's, I think, a very important one, that Anglicans and Catholics get on together in Sydney, for example, because they both accept that there are irreconcilable differences. Irreconcilable? Yes. Never ever?
Well, it's a brave man who says never ever, but I think it's a braver man who says that the Church of Rome is going to change, or that Protestant Anglicanism and the other Protestant churches will change. We've had a long, long history of getting on with each other in various ways. I just can't imagine why we would ever accept the authority of the Bishop of Rome as the condition of being the true church in some way, or why Rome would ever give ground on that.
Especially when so few Catholics do.
Well, strangely enough, I find often the Roman Catholics are more critical of the Pope than we who aren't Catholics. I don't know what that's about.
Peter Kirkwood, can I bring you in here? There seems to be a link here between what Bishop Forsyth's saying and the central thesis of your new book, The Quiet Revolution. You're basically saying that irreconcilable differences and their acknowledgement is very much the direction that interreligious dialogue is going.
Well, I've been sitting here with great interest listening to Bishop Forsyth and just noticing the great similarities between what he's saying and where interfaith dialogue is going, because I think when interfaith dialogue started, it did have a more universalist approach, that is saying, oh yes, underneath it all, we're all the same. But I think as it's gone on, where a lot of proponents of it these days seem to be is in recognising the deep differences and how do we interact productively with those differences? So there's a lot in common with what Robert's saying.
Away from a mushy belief that we're all praying to the same God and that we're all praying for the same thing, towards a more robust position. You describe it as particularist.
Yeah, definitely away from sort of the mushy, I think you were saying before, very lightheartedly, Stephen, you were saying before, it's getting away from the let's have a nice cup of tea model to, yes, let's have a rigorous discussion about what are our beliefs, where do we stand, what is the firm basis that we work from to deal with our differences.
Mm. And who are the main exponents of this quiet revolution you're talking about? There's a chapter in your book, I notice, on Raymond Panikkar, but another chapter on Stephanie Dowrick, now the Reverend Stephanie Dowrick, who I would have thought was exactly the opposite of what you're talking about.
Well, it's interesting that you've highlighted those two, because I think Stephanie is coming more from the universalist model. But someone like Panikkar, he has a term called mutual fecundation, which is a bit of a mouthful, but basically what it means is cross-fertilisation between difference.
Life's more interesting when we disagree.
That's right, that's right. And there can actually be productive engagement when we realise the deep differences and tussle with those and, hey, what you say may actually help me understand my thing better or deeper, even though my thing remains very different to yours.
Bishop Forsyth, the Sydney Anglicans have never really been big on ecumenical dialogue in the first place, have they?
Well, yes, they have, but only at the informal level. They're very strong links with other Protestant churches, very right back. You'll find the Brethren, Baptist, Presbyterian. At that level, denomination seems to almost become irrelevant at beach missions or university missions. At the formal level of bishop and bishop and councils, no, I think there's been far less.
You certainly stay away from the kinds of powwows with Muslims and Jews and Catholics and Uniting Church people all over Sydney that are happening these days.
I wouldn't want to quote that. I've spoken to a number of Christian and Jews, Council of Christian and Jews activities. I guess we're not as enthusiastic for them in the way that many are. It seems to me the question is, why are you dialoguing? One is, as Peter mentioned, you can learn, and that's important. There's also the fact we share the same space, we're in the same community, and one other reason to talk together is to help negotiate what is to be in a civil society in which there are irreconcilable differences of profound importance. And I know that certainly we Sydney Anglicans are very committed to religious freedom, protection from both the state trying to interfere and protect us from each other, which normally, as you notice from the Melbourne, the case there normally is a disaster, but also freedom to be robust and challenging each other. And that does require at times also making common cause with those with whom you don't agree in order to preserve
religious freedom. You're referring there to that Catch the Fire Ministries case.
Yes, which was an absolute disaster for freedom and for religion, and I think even for secularism, actually.
Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Peter Kirkwood is the author of The Quiet Revolution, just released by ABC Books. Robert Forsyth is the Anglican Bishop of South Sydney. That's all from us. Production this week by Jenny Parsonage and Noel Debien. You can get a transcript of the program on our website at abc.net.au/religion. I'm Stephen Crittenden. Goodbye till next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.